Welcome to Vital Voices. Today, our topic is prostate cancer, the most common cancer among men. As the American Cancer Society points out, prostate cancer can often be treated successfully, and catching it early can allow for more treatment options. To find out more about prostate cancer, we traveled to Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, to visit with Dr. Kristen Scarpato. Dr. Scarpato is Associate Professor of Urology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, as well as Residency Program Director and Vice Chair of Education for the Department of Urology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. On the day we talked, she had just emerged from performing surgery. Dr. Kristen Scarpato, thank you for joining us for Vital Voices.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
What is it about the prostate gland that makes it so susceptible to cancer?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. We know that there are some associations, some genetic associations, some environmental. But beyond that, I don't think we've cracked the code for what exactly makes it so susceptible. What you're getting at is it's the most commonly diagnosed cancer in men in the U.S. and a leader worldwide as well. Fortunately, most of the cancers are not lethal cancers, but we still need to do a better job of finding out which ones are lethal cancers.
Do you have any statistics on the number of prostate cancer diagnoses that occur in America annually?
Oh, gosh. I don't recall the exact statistic, but we do look to the American Cancer Society, who publishes stats on a yearly basis for the most incident cancer and then the most common cause of cancer-related death in prostate cancers. Well, far and away up there. So it accounts for 30%. I do remember that stat. 30% of cancer diagnoses in males. And the next closest is, you know, closer to 10%, and then all single digits below that.
What initially got you interested in urology and specifically treating the prostate?
You know, I really was attracted to a couple of things about urology. First, the people. As I was going through medical school and interacting with different specialists, I really enjoyed the people in urology because I think they were excited and optimistic and happy. And it seemed like a lot of that pertained to the second reason why I love urology, that you can really make a big difference in a patient's life. And sometimes it's as simple as placing a catheter for someone who's in urinary retention to complex, big reconstructive surgeries. But there's so much that urology entails, treating children, treating women, treating men, old, young. And there's a lot of innovation happening. You know, I think it's great that there are many ways to do the same thing. And in urology, I think a lot of that stems from the fact that we tend to be creative and look for ways to solve problems. And I liked being surrounded by that. When I was in urology residency, again, I was kind of excited about all the different possibilities. And it wasn't until I had this formative moment when my program director sent me to this course in at the time it was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and we were listening to lectures. It was called Basic Sciences. And there was a lecture on kidney cancer that just absolutely captivated me. And I spoke to the lecturer afterwards, Marston Linehan, who's a huge name and huge personality at the NIH. And he remembered that conversation and followed up with me unsolicited, like 2 months later, sent me an email and said, you know, hey, Kristen, I hope you're still interested in urologic oncology. It's a great specialty. Let me know if you want to talk. And I felt so special and like, wow, who's this big name remembering me? And that kind of coincided with when I started treating more prostate cancer and learning about the disease pathology and the controversy surrounding the management of prostate cancer, and that's when I said, I need to be a urologic oncologist. And over the past 11 years that I've been at Vanderbilt, I have started with a broad treating everything to now I'd say 75% of my practice is prostate cancer, from diagnosis through advanced prostate cancer to about 25% is non-muscle invasive bladder cancer.
When you're breaking the news to a patient that the tests for prostate cancer are positive, mm-hmm. how do you approach that?
Yeah, it's on the phone a lot of times now, and I think that presents some unique challenges because we do the biopsy and 2 or 3 days later, the patient gets the results in their my chart or my health at Vanderbilt, and we can't always ensure that they have a follow-up in-person appointment for that. So I think I start by saying, how are you recovering from your biopsy? And then saying, I know if you saw the report, you see a lot of numbers, and that can be really confusing. So let's go through it. The numbers correlate with your risk, and your risk tells us, do we need to do anything? Or if we do, how aggressive do we need to be with that? So I kind of start there. And then depending on if a patient is, you know, low, intermediate, or high risk, we go through kind of a high level view on the phone, and then they're scheduled for appropriate follow-up. Today, when someone is diagnosed with grade group 1 or Gleason 6 prostate cancer, I think I try and provide as much reassurance as possible. I think it's stressful to hear you have cancer. The C word is never a good one. But when you say, you know, there is an active debate right now about should we even call Gleason 6 or grade group 1 prostate cancer? And yes, we still are, but there's a debate because guess what? This is never going to shorten your life. This is never going to spread to other parts of your body. And so, you know, it's not something that we need to necessarily be aggressive about.
Our topic today on Vital Voices is prostate cancer. And our guest is Dr. Kristen Scarpato. Dr. Scarpato is Associate Professor of Urology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, as well as Residency Program Director and Vice Chair of Education for the Department of Urology. I want to talk about the Gleason scale in a little bit, but let's start with the PSA. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the role of the PSA in diagnosing prostate cancer and how that might have changed over the years.
Sure. PSA is really the workhorse in the screening of prostate cancer, and it is an imperfect test, but right now it's the best test we have. So PSA screening is something that should be undertaken thoughtfully in men who are, you know, aged 45 to 70 and have expected at least 10-year longevity. Sometimes we start screening earlier, as early as age 40, but never before age 40 for patients who are at higher risk. And after that thoughtful discussion, which the urologist is not admittedly the one who's usually having those conversations, it starts in primary care. That test can indicate to us whether or not we should be concerned about prostate cancer. We always confirm with a second test if the number is elevated. And if it is, and we've ruled out other causes of the PSA elevation, you know, an active infection or some recent procedure, then we usually pursue additional workup given that there is a risk of prostate cancer. And it depends on age, it depends on how high the elevation is. And typically now the next step is actually not a biopsy, it's an MRI to give us a better picture of the prostate and help us maximize our biopsy and the efficacy of the biopsy if there is a region of interest or area of concern of prostate cancer.
How do you now define elevated PSA?
Generally, we use a cut point of 3. It historically used to be 4. Now we're using 3, and that catches more prostate cancers, but we also see more false positives or elevations that are not from prostate cancer. And that reminds me that I didn't address your earlier question about PSA screening. it's been really controversial. And the USPSTF, United States Preventive Task Force Services, has altered their recommendation over time. Initially, there was a grade D recommendation against screening in older patients older than 75 because of the potential harms and overdiagnosis. Then that was extended to all patients. And so for a while, men weren't getting screened as they had been historically. And after some advocacy, including people like Dr. Penson here in our department, that recommendation was changed to a grade C, meaning shared decision making between patients and their providers for PSA screening. And now we're back to kind of seeing it more widely used, but there is some fallout from that. We are seeing some patients who are having delays in diagnosis related to that USPSTF recommendation, where, you know, whoever wasn't screening them. And so, you know, we're seeing those curves change, the American Cancer Society curves of prostate cancer mortality kind of flattening out as it had been decreasing for many years.
All right, let's say our imaginary patient today has elevated PSA, we do MRI, we do biopsy, and we get a Gleason reading. Mm-hmm. Explain how the Gleason scale works and what that tells you.
Sure. So based on what the pathologist sees under the microscope, if there's cancer positive, they give a grade, a Gleason number, to the most common pattern. And then the second number they give is the highest grade. So those two things combined give you a Gleason score. Cancer is considered anything between a 6 and a 10. So a 3 plus 3 is a Gleason 6. A 3 plus 4 is a Gleason 7. But guess what? So is a Gleason 4 plus 3. And that can be a little bit confusing. And recently, we've migrated to a grade grouping, which is a scale from 1 to 5. And that makes more intuitive sense for patients and for our counseling. I think if I said you have a grade group 1 prostate cancer, or let's say a grade group 2 prostate cancer on a scale of 1 to 5, you can interpret that that's a favorable intermediate risk diagnosis versus me saying you have a 3 plus 4 on a scale of 6 to 10, which puts you, it's not as clean. So the Gleason scoring or the grade grouping correlates with the patient's risk of spread and adverse pathology and prostate cancer mortality.
Well, you change direction a little bit here. Is there a way to detect prostate cancer through a urine test?
The short answer is no. But there are urine tests available that can give us a level of suspicion that a patient harbors cancer and that they should have a biopsy. We have a test here, in part developed by one of my colleagues, Jeff Tesoyan, My Prostate Score, which is a urine-based test that tells a patient their risk, low risk, or, you know, increasing risk of harboring important prostate cancer, and helping inform our decision to perform an MRI or do a biopsy.
Are there lifestyle choices or decisions that could possibly reduce a person's risk of getting prostate cancer?
I think so, and there's data in support of a couple of things. First, plant-based diet, actually. There's a lot of great work by Stacy Loeb looking at plant-based diets and your risk of developing prostate cancer and then your outcomes with prostate cancer. I do think that that's a little bit restrictive for most people. And let's be honest, fruits and vegetables are expensive these days. So what I recommend is that my patients follow a plant-forward diet and try and prioritize fruits and vegetables before eating other meats or more processed foods. And then secondarily, there's a lot of work in cancer in general that inflammation can lead to cancer. So limiting simple sugars and processed foods, I think, can be beneficial. We know that obesity can correlate with prostate cancer outcomes. There's not clear literature that obesity causes prostate cancer, but we know that it's associated with some of the prostate cancer outcomes. So maintaining a healthy weight is really important. And then smoking. You know, smoking is a risk factor for many cancers.
Are there urinary patterns that a man needs to look out for that might tip him off that he could have prostate cancer? I mean, are there symptoms? I know a lot of cases people are diagnosed and never knew they had it, but are there symptoms that you should pay attention to?
So oftentimes the answer is no. Usually patients don't know they have prostate cancer. It's only when prostate cancer is advanced that patients may experience symptoms of obstruction from prostate cancer blocking the flow of urine, or bone pain if there's been spread to the bones. The far and away, it's detected based on screening with a blood test or sometimes a digital rectal exam, but the symptoms are not generally present.
Right. Dr. Kristen Scarpato, thank you for joining us for Vital Voices.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
We have a lot more to talk about, so our discussion of prostate cancer will continue next weekend on Vital Voices as we look at various treatment options when a patient is diagnosed with prostate cancer and the factors to be considered for each of those treatment options. Our guest has been Dr. Kristen Scarpato. She is Associate Professor of Urology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. She also serves as Residency Program Director and Vice Chair of Education for the Department of Urology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. For Vital Voices, I'm Fred Sossman.